Focus Ireland helped a record-breaking 1,829 households to avoid homelessness or to find a secure home last year. To discuss this and related matters, I'm joined on the line by its Director of Advocacy, Mike Allen. Mike, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks, Ciara.
What's particularly worrying about that number, really in any context, but particularly in the context of the pandemic, was that there was a ban on evictions in that time frame.
Absolutely, yes. So we worked with over 12,000 individuals over what was an extraordinary, very difficult year. And as you say, we were successful with 1,800 households, either in preventing them from becoming homeless or supporting them out. Most of the households that were facing homelessness during that period, as you say, there was an eviction ban. So some of those would have involved threatened illegal evictions. But in most cases, they would be where somebody didn't necessarily have a tenancy in their own right, and they were living with somebody else or living in circumstances where the eviction ban wouldn't actually be relevant. So what you saw over last year with the eviction ban was a huge reduction in the number of families becoming homeless, because evictions, particularly landlords selling up or moving family members back in or to a lesser extent doing renovations, are the primary reason for families becoming homeless. So the number of families becoming homeless during the year fell very substantially, but we, with the local authorities right across the country, continued to be very successful in supporting families out of homelessness. So thus you see this very substantial and very welcome decline last year in family homelessness by up to a quarter. Unfortunately, the government didn't continue the eviction ban despite its effectiveness, and so we're beginning to see the figures for family homelessness creep back up.
And that was particularly apparent, Mike, in the release by the Department of Housing of the August homelessness figures, where there was a notable increase in family homelessness.
Absolutely. So that's really coming back. But the pattern, it's worth saying, the pattern in single people's homelessness, sometimes that's two adults, it's a couple. We tend to ignore that sometimes, but certainly households without children was very different. And that continued to rise all the way through the pandemic. I think one of the factors that's going on there is that eviction can be very important for that group, but it's much more likely to be that people didn't have a tenancy in the first place, or they were in a relationship and they were leaving, or they were coming out of a hospital or prison or a mental health institution or somewhere and straight into homelessness. So it's a very different picture between single person's homelessness and family homelessness of the causes and solutions. And that's why we've always said that you need not necessarily separate strategies, but you definitely need clearly targeted approaches to deal with the different nature of the two problems.
Because it does seem at present that the state response in many instances is a monolith. If you are homeless, you're homeless. We're not going to look at the manner of your homelessness or your family composition, if indeed there is a family.
Yeah, I think it's very different at the front line. Local authorities, some local authorities are very good at recognizing that and dealing at a human-centered way with the issue. But that's not really reflected at national policy level. If you look at Housing for All, we were delighted with the commitment to work towards ending homelessness by 2030 and some other aspects of it. But it was disappointing to just see such a very limited mention of the particular dynamic of family homelessness and what we've learned about it over the years, and specifically not to mention the problems that are faced by children. That's very disappointing. And we hope to be working with government over the immediate future to try and rectify. If it's not in the strategy, it's not the end of the world, as long as we can actually get it implemented.
Because I would imagine, Mike, that if a child spends any period of time during their formative years experiencing homelessness, be that in emergency accommodation or elsewhere, that experience will stay with them throughout their lives.
Yeah, it's such a very difficult thing to discuss, because you don't want to be saying something to families, to parents who've experienced homelessness in some sense. They're cursed, or there's something they can never escape. Of course, there are things we can do to ameliorate the trauma of homelessness. But we have to first of all recognize that simply losing your home and becoming homeless is in itself a trauma. And then the experience of being in homeless accommodation is also traumatic. And the lack of engagement with that issue in current strategy. For instance, under the last Dáil, if you like, under the last government, there was private sector legislation, private members legislation from Janet Sullivan, trying to change the legislation so that the homeless legislation, which is all written with the assumption that it's basically single men who are becoming homeless, doesn't mention families and certainly doesn't mention children, to add a piece of into the legislation which would have said the local authority must, in all dealings with a family that's homeless, take the best interest of the child into account. Fairly simple, but piece of legislation which follows through what we did over 10 years ago, changing the constitution to put the interests of children at the heart of the constitution. Everybody said that was a good idea. It went past the first reading and has never been heard of since. And why, if everybody thinks it's a good idea and agrees it would make a difference, why do these things just never actually happen? It's very, very frustrating, and it would make a significant difference. So most of the children in homeless accommodation don't have a child support worker. Focus Ireland has child support workers through HSE and TUSLA and their own resources. But most children don't have access to them. And it would be a huge thing to do. And it would be a brilliant thing to do. It's supposed to be a European guarantee for children being promoted. And the government have made a big issue of that. And the European Union have told Ireland to make sure it looks after homeless children in that. And yet we haven't heard anything about actual measures which would make a difference for those children.
But I suppose ultimately, Mike, without any of the interventions or legislative evolutions that you have noted there that seem to be gathering dust on a shelf, and in the context of rising rents, a tightening of supply, we're just going to see more people of all kinds of families and of none entering into homelessness.
Well, we don't accept that as inevitable. We think that the government is serious about the commitment to try and end homelessness by 2030. They're going to have to do an awful lot more than is currently written down in paper. But I think they know that. And at our launch today, launch of our 2020 annual report, the founder of the organisation, Sister Stan Stoss Kennedy, was calling on the government to sort of fill in the gaps there. So we're saying, we're going to have eliminated homelessness by 2030. Well, what are the steps along the way? What do we hope to have achieved by next year, the year after that, the year after that? What does this government expect to have achieved by the time it goes to the electorate? These are reasonable questions that I think that Sister Stan asked the government to fill in. We're not pointing fingers at government and saying, look, you've got to do this. We can only achieve that goal of turning this around and ending homelessness by working together. So what we're asking for is the opportunity to set those milestones together. There's no point in the government setting them and us saying they're unrealistic. Mm. There's no point in us saying, oh, we've got to achieve this, and them saying it's unrealistic. We need to sort of sit down and say, like, that's where we're going to head together. How together, ourselves, all the other homeless organisations, and the housing organisations, the approved housing bodies and so on, local authorities particularly important, TUSLA and the Department of Education, how do we collectively move from where we are now, which, as you're saying, is things are deteriorating, to where we want to be. And I think that's a task that Focus Ireland is certainly putting itself forward as ready to participate in.
Mike Allen, Director of Advocacy for Focus Ireland, thank you indeed for joining us. And on a not entirely unrelated matter, joined now on the line by Karen Kiernan. She's Chief Executive of One Family, which is part of the National One Parent Family Alliance. Karen, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
You are in the Alliance, and indeed in One Family, are calling for urgent government action in Budget 2022 to loosen poverty's grip on one-parent families, of whom there are around 20,000 here in County Kildare. And just referring back to my piece with Mike Allen of Focus Ireland, one-parent families would be at greater risk, or at heightened risk, arguably, than other family types and cohorts in some instances of homelessness.
Oh yeah, most actually homeless families are one-parent families. And that's borne out in the figures right around the country. So what you see is a whole number of really difficult barriers and circumstances which leads to often a single mother and one or two children ending up in homeless accommodation for very long periods of time because there simply isn't anywhere for them to live and they can't afford private rented accommodation. So many of the families we work with in Dublin, for example, their addresses are hotel numbers. You know, we've worked with families over a very long period of time where their children are growing up in homeless accommodation. So it is a real issue. It's also an issue for people, I suppose, coming out of a marriage or a long-term relationship where there's a family home. And that somehow, you know, if you separate, children are going to spend time with, you know, ideally, unless there's a reason not to, they're going to spend time with both of their parents, and they need somewhere to do that. So the costs of separating are really, really high because both families need somewhere to live. And so that's really difficult. And what we've seen is that for some separated parents, they've been excluded from some of the government support schemes around housing, even though they're struggling again on their own with very little assets or carrying a lot of debt. So it's a complicated situation, but there is no doubt that if you're parenting on your own, unfortunately, you're more likely to live in poor quality accommodation and you're more likely to be homeless.
And it's also, there are additional costs associated with being a one-parent family. And that's one of the key things that you're asking, you and the National One-Parent Family Alliance is asking the government to take cognizance of as it puts the finishing touches to Budget 2022, particularly in terms of the social protection system.
Yeah, I mean, what we're worried about, the reason 9 national organisations came together last year during COVID was because we saw the dreadful problems faced by children and parents and one-parent families. And we know that child poverty rates are higher, unfortunately, for people, for children living in one-parent families. So we know that the system, such as it is, isn't working for them. The structure is not helping people. So if you think about the 2 biggest costs in Ireland, they're accommodation and childcare. So if you're trying to do that on one income, or if you're, you know, having to live on social welfare, it's practically impossible to meet those costs. It's really difficult for, you know, a middle class 2-parent family to meet those costs, yeah. Never mind somebody on their own or on low income. And it's just the social welfare system isn't necessarily built to support people who are parenting on their own. So if people do, we see a lot of people, they're moving into work, they're getting on with their education, and what happens is they lose so many benefits. Work doesn't pay and it doesn't make sense, and they actually can't afford to lose their medical card or their housing support. Because what we need are tapered supports. It's not that people need to be on these things forever, they don't, but they need to have a level of income where they can move off. And that's difficult if you're in low-paid part-time employment, which is what many lone parents are in, because they can't get childcare. So there's quite a bit of a vicious circle here. And what we're saying is you can see in the poverty figures how difficult it is. And we don't want children to be held back. We don't want children to not have the same quality of life as others. We want to support them. And that's the country that we live in. You know, that's not what this country wants. It's not what people want.
And I suppose in quite the same way as the social protection system doesn't take account of single parent families and their very specific needs, likewise, the early years and childcare policies don't take cognizance of that either.
Well, sorry, just to say they all do to some degree, but not enough, not to the degree that it works. So, yeah, one of the problems with the early years is that actually in the new system, which has worked really well for many parents and children, for many one-parent families, they've lost some childcare support, and that's really difficult. So for people in education and training, they've lost some of the hours that they would have had. And we're also seeing that the National Childcare Scheme counts child benefit. It also counts child maintenance as income. And really, we're saying those things should be left out of it because they're for children. And it's just a way of getting targeted childcare to families who need it the most instead of everybody getting maybe equal access, because not everyone needs it. It's how can we target this to children and families that need it the most. And for children who are living in homeless accommodation, maybe living in direct provision, or they're living in traveller accommodation, or they're living anywhere that's not, you know, as good as it could be, extra hours in a high quality earlier centre could really be helpful to them, or in school age childcare, you know, so for after school, parents trying to work who are parenting on their own can find it really difficult to do shift work, can find it really difficult to get their children minded after school. You know, all of those things that are difficult for every parent are doubly, trebly hard if you're parenting on your own.
It doesn't sound on the face of it, Karen, as if the measures that the Alliance is calling for are particularly costly. They're more about refocusing how those resources are fairly distributed.
I think that's it. I suppose there's a lot of kite flying at the moment about the budget in terms of who get what, particularly around social welfare payments. And I suppose what we're really calling on the government to do is to look at the evidence look at the data, look at what the research is telling you. Who are the poorest people in Ireland? I can tell you their children. Who are the people, you know, who need a little bit more investment? They may not be able to vote yet, but children will grow up and their parents can vote. Mm. And it's really important that they get supported and they use the government uses the research they paid for to be able to make evidence-based policy decisions in the budget next week. So we don't, you know, condemn a generation of children to a life that where they can't meet their full potential. You know, that we can do better than that as a country, and we have to do that.
Karen Kiernan, Chief Executive of One Family, which is itself a keynote part of the National One Parent Family Alliance. Thank you indeed for joining us. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and somewhere in the region of 3,700 people are diagnosed with breast cancer in Ireland every year. A keynote part of the Irish Cancer Society's campaign is Care for Your Pair. And in or around two-thirds of women don't frequently check their breasts for lumps or changes. And breast cancer also affects men. And I would imagine the proportion of men who regularly check their pectoral area is relatively low. But breast cancer does come to many, many households across the land. And it has come to the O'Brien household, joined on the line now by Kildare-based mother of two, Aoife O'Brien. Aoife, you're very welcome to the programme.
Oh, thanks for having me, Ciara.
Absolutely delighted to do so. Tell us your story.
Well, I would have been one of the women that you described there that doesn't normally check their breasts, I have to say. And it was about August 2020 that I noticed a change. And the reason that I noticed it was actually that I had pain. I had breast pain. And at the time, I had been doing quite a lot of running, and I had been doing a bit of research about how to kind of tailor your training to fit in with your menstrual cycle. And so for that reason, I was paying really close attention to all the symptoms of my menstrual cycle. And so I knew for me, it was normal to have breast pain the week before my period was due. And so I had that breast pain, and I thought, well, that's normal. But then the next week, my period had started, and I still had the breast pain. And I thought, well, that's not normal for me. And so that led me then to kind of look at my breast in the mirror, and I could see the skin was rippled, and I could see the breast was a bit misshapen. So I felt, and I thought, oh, there is something there. And I suppose in typical fashion, then I put my clothes back on and forgot about it, and, well, tried to forget about it. And when I looked at it again the next day, it was still there. It hadn't miraculously sorted itself out. So I knew enough to know that that was a warning sign that I needed to go and get seen to then. So I contacted my GP at that stage. Now, I was a bit concerned that she wouldn't see me because of COVID, you know, and they were being very cagey about who they were letting through the doors at that stage, you know. But I was reassured that I should come in and be seen. And yeah, my GP examined me and agreed that it needed further investigation. So again, I suppose I was concerned about COVID and that there would be a big backlog of appointments and whether even having appointments with that at this stage. But she assured me that, yes, they were. These things were a priority, you know. So I was also, I have to say, there was something that crossed my mind. I thought, I have no health insurance. And she asked me, did I have a preference about which hospital I went to? And I thought, oh, God, I have no health insurance. I'll go to whatever hospital will take me, you know.
Yeah.
But she said, well, actually, the public health system is really comprehensive, and it's really a really good way to go. And, you know, she was absolutely right. I had the best of care then from that point onwards. And I was referred into the matter, and I was tested. On the 10th of September, I was tested in the Mater Breast Health Clinic. And on the 24th of September, then I was diagnosed with stage 1 HER2 positive breast cancer.
And I suppose, but for your vigilance, but for you trying to change up your training regime, you know, it could be a considerable months or perhaps years after before you may have checked your breast, because most people don't do it.
Absolutely. And I think the fact that I had pain was kind of lucky in that regard, because a lot of people wouldn't have any pain. And it was because I had the pain that really drew my attention to it, you know, and that I had been paying attention to my own menstrual cycle symptoms and things. It could have gone on for a long time without being noticed at all.
And where are you in terms of treatment, Aoife?
I just finished my last treatment on the 24th of September this year. So it was a full year from diagnosis to the end of my treatment. So I'm now cancer-free and treatment over.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, that's brilliant news, though. I mean, it must have been, I can almost imagine that cold river of fear that probably ran through your stomach when that day that you first noticed it and quickly put back on your clothes and went on about your business. Because that's such a natural reaction. We'd nearly all do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and just that you kind of talk yourself out of things, then you think, ah, sure, it's probably nothing. You know, it'll probably be gone. You know, by tomorrow, it'll be fine. You know, and you can kind of talk yourself out of thinking that there is something there.
You wish it away.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and when I had when the GP had referred me to the matter, I was looking on their website to see what was involved in all the tests. And at the very bottom, it said in big black writing, most lumps are not breast cancer, you know. And I thought, well, there you go. It's probably not. But, you know, maybe it was something, you know, and I think that's something you have to remember. It might be nothing, but it might be something. And so it's always worth going and getting it checked out.
Have you had a celebration since being declared cancer free?
Oh, I haven't stopped celebrating. Well, I turned 40 in August, so we had a big celebration for that as well. So
that was a huge month then. Huge birthday and incredible news all in the one go.
Yes, yeah.
And are you still doing your training? The training that enabled you to be able to realise, look, I need to get this checked out.
Well, I'm very, very slowly getting back into it. I was referred onto an exercise program from the Mater. It was called Exwell Medical. And I went along to a few exercise classes. And I have to say, the first couple, I found them so tough because I've lost so much fitness and strength and everything, you know. And I found that really hard, that it was so challenging when, you know, I could have flown through it, say, 18 months ago. But I think more than anything, that's given me the confidence to try and get back into the world of training and exercise. So I'm very, very cautiously, you know, dipping my toe back in the water again and getting out there and getting active. So I've set myself a goal to run a park run by Christmas, which I think is hopefully achievable anyway.
Absolutely. Well, Aoife O'Brien, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon to share with us your story. And I suppose everybody should take a leaf out of Aoife's book. And if you notice anything untoward, anything that shouldn't be there on your breasts or elsewhere, go to your GP as soon as is humanly possible. And as we said, this is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, very much supported and advocated by the Irish Cancer Society. And if you have any concerns or worries about breast cancer or any other type of cancer, you can contact the Irish Cancer Society's cancer nurse through the free phone support line. That's 1800 200 700. 1800 200 700. And that line is open Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. Joined on the line now by Buzz O'Neill. He is an event manager and club promoter. Buzz O'Neill Maxwell, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hi, Ciara. Thanks for having me.
Delighted to do so. It's kind of hard to prepare for the throngs of people who want to be back in a club environment without actually knowing if you'll be able to operate at capacity or what structures and restrictions you're supposed to have in place.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the key word you used there in your introduction was majority of restrictions are expected to be lifted. You know, we don't know what those restrictions are, what is getting lifted. If it's everything, great. But also, if it's not, either way, we need to know now. We don't need to know in another week. We don't even know by the end of this week, you know. We really, really need to know today. It's 17 days to reopening. And there's no guidelines being issued. There's nothing being issued, you know. It's complete silence. They made the announcement, was it five, six weeks ago, that the 22nd of October would be the date. And we're now facing down the barrel of exactly what happened to bars, restaurants, hotels, and the rest of the hospitality industry, where the government just sit on their hands to the very last minute. We can't operate like that, you know. That might work for government. It doesn't work for us that are trying to run business.
On a purely logistical basis, were the 22nd of October the first time of an easing of restriction that affected in particular one sector over another? You could understand government scrabbling to get their act together. But as you've said, we've had successive levels of easing or changing or ramping up of restrictions. And on successive occasions, it's hospitality and tourism which are having to hang around and wait. And now we can, for the first time since the beginning of the pandemic, include nightclubs in that bracket of people who are trying to operate in a vacuum of information.
Yeah, precisely that. Because, you know, as I said, they've had many goals at this now, at this stage. You know, they really should have this right by now. You know, we've sat patiently. We have sat in our hands for 19 months, and it's been pretty terrible for us, you know. Why they're adding another level of stress and annoyance to our industry at the last minute is beyond me, you know. I mean, what we really want to know, what we want to get to the nub of, really, very simply, is what is capacity opening on the 22nd? If it's reduced capacity, that has ramifications for a lot of venues. Some venues won't open. Mm. Some promoters, like myself, would have to seriously consider going ahead with the events that we have planned. And all these, that weekend, it's a bank holiday weekend. It will be the reopening weekend. And I'm sold out. All of them, I have four clubs on that weekend. They're all sold out. But, you know, if we have to then reduce our capacity, we have to look at, does it even make financial sense for us to open? You know, we've had no income for 19 months. I'm not going to reopen on the first weekend and lose money.
But it's also a logistical headache. If Buzz, all of those four events that you're organising are all sold out, and let's say, for example, government decides, look, you can operate at 75% capacity. How do you decide who you're going to say no to? How are you going to refund them? Those kind of events may be one-off events only. So it's not as if this might be a recurring series of events. You can say, look, I'll be back on next week. How do you come back? Because the nighttime economy functions in a very different way to the daytime economy.
Yeah, precisely. And we, you know, what do I do if we are reduced capacity? I'm faced with no other option but to refund everybody, put those tickets back on sale at the reduced capacity once I've done my maths and make sure that it is financially viable for me to run an event with only 75% capacity. And, you know, what if it's 60%? I can tell you now, if it's 60%, it's absolutely a no-go for me. Those clubs will not be open. I will not be running those events. I can't make money at 60%. So at 75%, you do the math yourself. The margin is tiny. Is it worthwhile? Of course it is, because, you know, we're desperate to get open. You know, not only are those events sold out, I have wait lists of hundreds and hundreds of people. You know, so the appetite is there from people. You know, I see some polls online and stuff in the last day or two, and, you know, polls are skewed online, as we know. And
yeah,
people are like, oh, well, I'm not that eager to go out. Well, I'm sorry, if you're of a certain age, and I don't want to be ageist here, because this, let's face it, I'm 51, so I'm including myself in this, but if you're sitting at home doing polls on the journal, you're probably not my target market. You know, I mean, the kids want to go out. It's universal.
But as did we, each and every one of us, when we were at that kind of age bracket. So I don't think anybody's being critical of somebody wanting to go out and to club all night long or for as long as is humanly possible. But the net effect, Buzz, for people who are you, and also in a similar position, staging events, if the capacity is at 60%, it's not financially viable in an awful lot of situations. There will be some operators that can continue on that basis. But it also means, yes, you're going to have to refund all of those who bought tickets. It also means all of the staff at that venue will not work on that night or until capacity is lifted. And all of the suppliers to that venue will not have any contracts to fulfill or goods and services to supply until capacity is raised.
Yeah, and I mean, and that is it. I mean, it's a knock-on effect. You know, it's the knock-on effect that happened when we closed down for all those reasons that you've just stated, and all those people that won't be working, that we're banking on this being the great reveal, the great weekend of our reopening. And some venues that are self-sufficient and don't rely on an outside promoter or anybody else, they just open up.
Yeah.
I'm sure they could probably open up at 60%, but when you have another promoter coming in who's hiring the venue like I might be, and then I pay all the DJs and staff and all this, I've already spent money. I've spent money I do not have, by the way, you know. You know, I've spent a lot of money on advertising and marketing and deposits and for DJs and all of those things that you have to fork out in advance. And, you know, it's an absolute disaster. But I think, to get back to the main point, it doesn't need to be a disaster. What we're asking the government today is just to tell us now. We see no reason. I know they're probably keeping an eye on hospitalizations, and I'm not going to get into vaccination numbers, because we're leading Europe and leading the world in those numbers at this stage. So from that point of view, I really don't understand why we're even considering any sort of restrictions at this stage. You know, who are we protecting now? Are we protecting people who don't want to get a vaccination? Well, they ain't welcome in the club then. You know, I mean, we just need to get on with it.
Well, the argument could also be made that if the government wasn't willing to say today what will happen, that doesn't preclude them saying, look, on October 22nd, if X, then Y, or if A, then B. So therefore, you would know there are two options
absolutely.
In the mix, and you might find out next Tuesday which they are. You can pull the trigger there and put in place your contingency plans.
Yes, absolutely. We want either an answer or a solution or you know, listen, this is what we do for a living. We run events. We find solutions. We're inventive people. But, you know, we need to know what the options are. And right now, we don't know what the options are. You know, if we're going by what they said 6 weeks ago, then it is. It's fine. It's 100%, and we're reopening. But if you see the language that the Taoiseach used on that press conference on the day, hopefully is used, maybe is used. And you know, so it is not written in stone that we can open at full capacity. You know, we've lobbied hard. You know, they had their pilot test event for the club last week, and you know, honestly, I really thought there was no point in it, but it was a great thing that it did happen. At least it was government engaging in trying to get our sector reopened, and from all accounts, it was a brilliant night. But you know, so is there data available from that? Is any of the data any use? And are they going to share it with any of us in the nightclub industry? You know, these are all questions that we don't have any answers to.
Well, Buzz O'Neill Maxwell, nightclub promoter and event manager, thank you indeed for joining us. Now, I'm joined on the line by Corina Fitzsimons. She's PR and communications manager at Dogs Trust. Corina, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks for having us on, Ciara.
Delighted to do so. You're here to talk about Agnes, and Agnes has had thus far, if you'll excuse the pun, a dog's life, but she's very much on the road to recovery and a forever home.
Yeah, poor Agnes. She's a white lurcher, about 4 years of age, and she was dumped from a vehicle near a rehoming centre in Dublin not long after she'd given birth to a litter of puppies. Now, thankfully, a group of people who were travelling in cars behind the vehicle that this happened from saw what happened, and they got out and they managed to corral her because she was running terrified, like she could have been killed, and they managed to catch her and bring her to safety, and then they brought her to us, thankfully.
Now, when she arrived at your door, and huge thanks and praise to those really, really kind passers-by, because they could have just driven on and nobody would have known any different. But they said, no, we're not going to do that today. She was skin and bone when she arrived at the door in Finglas, Corina.
She was. It was, like, to be honest, we thought really long and hard about releasing the photograph that we did. And that's actually the least graphic photo. I think when you've got it before and after, it's not as upsetting because you now know that she's in a good place.
Yeah.
But when she first came in, she actually just collapsed on the floor and just completely and utterly gave up. And our rehoming centre assistant manager, Sandra, actually had to carry her physically. And Sandra's only a tiny person. She had to carry her down to the vet because she just literally, she like no energy or just kind of gave up the will to live, to be honest. So she went into a foster home, and then within a space of a few weeks, literally she looked like a different dog, which makes it all the more upsetting because it just goes to show what a little bit of love and care and the right food, you know, and care, like basic care, that she looked like a different dog. And the people who fostered her were absolutely amazing, and they sent us lots of videos and, you know, footage of her at home, you know, relaxing and coming out of her shell, and it was just amazing to see the transformation in such a short space of time.
Well, to be honest, Corina, like the bare minimum of care would have kept Agnes in good health and in good condition. It took a considerable time for her to become as emaciated as she did, so there were choices, we would imagine, barring any other information available to us about where Agnes may have been living. It seemed that there were choices made about her care, and those choices culminated in somebody choosing not to contact an organisation such as yourself, saying, I can't look after this dog anymore, but rather dumping her on the side of the road in the dead of night.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, obviously, we have to keep an open mind as to, you know, the vehicle that she was dumped from. Were they the owners? Had they found her somewhere? We honestly don't know.
Yeah.
But we don't know what drives people to abandon dogs either. We don't know, you know, what situation their life is in, etc. But at the end of the day, we're not here to judge anybody. But there is no reason to dump a dog in that condition at the side of a road. You know, we were only down the road. And we're always available for advice. It may be a case that we can't take, you know, in every dog or a dog at a certain time. And that's why we're appealing for foster homes, because when you can see the difference a foster home made to Agnes, we want to be able to do that for even more dogs. And we're being inundated with surrender requests at the moment as, you know, lockdown ends. And just the more people who can help us to foster, the more dogs we'll be in a position to help.
So how does fostering a dog work? Does the dog come and live with you for a defined period of time, for however long they need, rather than any other factor? What's the criteria?
It really depends on the dog, to be honest. It could be, you know, you could be fostering a puppy, you could be fostering a dog who's had surgery, you could be fostering a dog who's quite elderly, or a dog who just isn't coping in a rehoming centre. So it just really depends. We actually have regional rehoming projects around the country, so you can foster, you don't have to live near a rehoming centre. We're always looking for a foster homes all around the country. And basically, we'll give you advice, we'll, you know, you'll either come to meet the dog, or depends on where you live, we drop the dog out to you. And it just really depends on how long you've got. Some people contact us, say, for example, we get a lot of teachers contacting us during the summer saying, look, I'm not going to be teaching for the duration of the summer, would I be able to foster a dog for 3 months? And it's a brilliant opportunity for people who can't commit to dog ownership, but want to be able to help in some way, or are considering getting a dog, because sometimes, you know, when they foster, they may think, oh, God, no, that was too much for me. I don't want to be a dog owner. And it's also fantastic for families to see if the children will actually pick up after the dog, like they promised.
No, they won't. We already know that, but that's all right. And Karina, if somebody listening is considering fostering a dog, do they need to have previous dog ownership experience? Do they need to have a massive back garden? Can they live in an apartment?
We'd generally be looking for people who have a secure back garden, just because the dogs may not be toilet trained, and they also may not, you know, be used to be out on a lead. So it's just, you know, for ease of getting the dog to exercise and toilet outside, we'd ask for a secure garden. Also that you can drive as well, in case you have to bring the dog to the vet. And preferably if you have experience with dogs, we'd be really keen to hear from you. But even if you don't, we just never know what comes through our doors, and we're always looking for help from people. And if you're interested, please see dogstrust.ie/foster.
Karina Fitzsimons, PR and Communications Manager at Dogs Trust, thank you indeed for joining us. And if you want to see the spectacular level of love and care Agnes's foster family lavished upon her and brought her back to rude good health, you can do so either on our Twitter account at KFM Radio, or you can go on to the Dogs Trust Twitter account at dogstrust_.ie.